All other American breeds, the quarter horse and standard bred and all the rest, also have in their veins the blood of this one horse, Justin Morgan. And it was the grave of the horse I went looking for, not that of the man. I found it by turning east on an unmarked dirt road south of Chelsea, taking a covered bridge across the first branch of the White River, climbing a steep hill to the right, and driving on until I thought, my God, I must have missed it. And suddenly, there it was, a modest monument in a small field of the farm where Justin Morgan was kicked to death by another horse at the age of 32. I read the stone and walked around there for a few minutes. I felt I was in the presence of greatness, in a hillside meadow across the road from Justin Morgan's monument. A couple of Morgan horses were grazing, long necks, short backs, full manes and tails, just like him. The beauty of Vermont owes much to its livestock. Noel Perrin, the best writer about Vermont rural life, says the reason Vermont is prettier than New Hampshire, just across the river, is that New Hampshire farmers have mostly given up milking cows in favor of milking tourists, and their pastures are grown over in scrub woods. Vermont farmers, a lot of them, are still hanging on. Their cows keep the valleys open and green. I thought about this one day on a drive from Manchester up through Dorset and Pawlet in the green valley of the Metowee River. It's as pretty as countryside gets. But it wouldn't be, I realized, without the dairy herds of Jerseys and Guernseys to keep the meadows trimmed. Sheep are returning to Vermont, too. They far outnumbered cattle in the state once upon a time. Here and there, spinning wheels and shuttles are back in action again. You can buy Vermont weaving made with Vermont wool. The wool comeback is too late for the old Downers Mill at Queechy, though. Simon Pierce moved his glass and pottery factory there from Ireland, and the water that flows over the dam now powers Pierce's glass furnaces instead of Downer's looms. In Vermont, where quilts and hook rugs and stained glass, pottery, and handmade furniture are also being made everywhere, the Industrial Revolution has given way to the craft revival. It would be nice to think that the Vermont economy could survive on farming and crafts alone, but the state always needs a few more jobs than it has. Many of its young people have to leave each year to seek their fortunes, and many of those who stay have to work at several jobs to make ends meet. The image of the frugal Yankee has a solid basis in fact. A dollar in the pocket is still worth something in Vermont. Vermont will be all right as long as it's home to people like my old friends George and June Butler. They bought their farm in Jacksonville in the 50s. He was an activist Methodist preacher who looked upon the church as an instrument of social change. A good minister, George once said to me, calls on people and raises hell. George started raising hell with the comfortable establishment at Yale Divinity School in the 30s. He never stopped. When I went to see the two of them on this trip, he gave me a brief sermon for free. He sat at the kitchen table with his unruly shock of white hair and his firm jaw. He fixed me with his clear eyes and quoted to me from the Book of Amos in that stentorian preacher's voice, "Let judgment run down as waters, and righteousness as a mighty stream." He declared that is the high water mark of the Old Testament. I have tried to put it into practice. George Butler is a man of iron principles. I'm sure the farm, as much as anything, was a place to escape from conservative parishioners and authoritarian bishops. The farm was in disrepair, George said. There was only one room in the house, and it hadn't been occupied for several years. It was full of spiders and the old farmer's broken-down beekeeping equipment. We bought the 175 acres for $15,000, declared it a tree farm, and harvested $2,000 worth of trees the first year, so that made it affordable. The farmhouse is now as inviting as a home can be, and the farm as tidy as any in Vermont. I first met the Butlers 25 years ago in maple sugaring season. The sugaring helped us get by, George said. We had 1,000 buckets on these trees, and we started at sunup every day. Once I boiled all night. We gave attention to the quality of the syrup, and we got a good price. A tiny brook comes rushing down out of the mountains behind the house. One day, George Butler decided that stream could help pay the bills, too. He said, I built a 4.5-foot dam half a mile up in the woods. For a turbine, I used a pump running backwards. It turns out 60-cycle power. We produce 3 times as much electricity as we can use at the house. The power company buys the excess at about 5 cents per kilowatt hour. We get all the power we can use for free, and some months as much as $300 to boot, all from a little brook that doesn't even have a name. So that's how to survive in Vermont. Fix up your house by yourself, sell a little timber, do a little sugaring, generate your own electricity. And I should add, teach music, as June did, and play the old pump organ on Sundays at the community church. And if you're qualified, as George was, do a little supply preaching and write a few freelance articles. Oh, and George's book about his boyhood is coming out this fall. Neither of them was born in Vermont. They are Vermonters to the bone. We couldn't do without the seasons, George said. Or the neighbors, June said. When I was laid up with my back problem, they came in and did my housework, took care of the garden, and fetched my groceries. I could never repay them, except, of course, by doing the same for somebody else. George and June are a cosmopolitan couple by life experience, and they might have chosen to settle down anywhere. They deliberately chose Vermont and a hard-working, old-fashioned life. I heard this attitude of Vermonters described as preventing the future. When you're sitting at the table with the Butlers in one of the rooms they built themselves, looking out at their fir tree the chickadees like so much, when you're crossing the covered bridge at Woodstock or driving up Mount Equinox with its unspoiled views out across the state, when you're strolling on the common at Townsend in October or on the Weston Green, when you're looking down on Pomfret from the Cloudland Road and noticing all the ugliness that isn't there anywhere to be seen, and when you think about what so much of the rest of America has become, preventing the future in this one small place doesn't seem like such a bad idea. November, Rio Grande Valley, New Mexico. New Mexico may have been new to the Spanish who rode north from Old Mexico, but in the unimaginable eons of history, that was just the blink of an eye ago. The place is badly named. It should be called Precambria, for the sea that crashed upon its shores for tens of millions of years. Or Mastodonia, for the mammals that later roamed its plains in the company of elephants and camels and saber-toothed cats. Or Sandia, for the mountain where the camp of an Ice Age hunter, the earliest known American, was found in a cave. Nowhere in the United States have human beings lived as long in the same community as at Acoma, the Pueblo in the Sky, built atop a New Mexico mesa in the 1100s by the Anasazi, the Ancient Ones. New Mexico is old, stupendously old and dry and brown, and wind-worn by the ages. I went to New Mexico in November to be overcome again by oldness. And because I knew that in November I could see the cranes again. I saw them first many Novembers ago and heard their triumphant trumpet calls, 100 or more sandhill cranes riding south on a thermal above the Rio Grande Valley. And that day their effortless flight and their brassy music got into my soul. They are giant birds with 6-foot wingspans, graceful gliders in the air, dainty stilt dancers on the ground, each mating pair inseparable for life. I've long been acquainted with a couple of them who spend every short summer in the same secluded corner of the same Montana marsh. They arrive in late May, spiraling noisily out of the blue sky, and remain well into September, feeding and guarding their nest. Then, suddenly, around the autumnal equinox, they're gone. I've never seen them go. A morning arrives, there is silence in the marsh. They're gone. Where they go, I think, is south and east across the Continental Divide to a vast meadow near the Henry's Fork River in Idaho, where they meet other cranes in a late September rendezvous that may last a week or more. After stumbling upon that meadow one year, I stood with binoculars on a hill and counted 100 socializing pairs, rising restlessly into the air, settling back to earth, rising, resettling, awaiting some signal of wind or weather or intuition to tell them exactly when to rise and not return. They form at last into a shifting V formation and climb toward the clouds above the mountains to the south down the front range of the Rockies. By mid-November, the destination of thousands of cranes lies just ahead, New Mexico. Most of them are headed for Phil Norton's place. Phil Norton is manager of the Bosque del Apache National Wildlife Refuge, so named for the Mescalero Apaches who used to camp in the woods nearby. The refuge straddles the Rio Grande about 175 miles north of the Mexican border, overseen by this genial Texan who worked for years in the fish and wildlife bureaucracy in Washington, sometimes dreaming a simple dream of a refuge he could call his own. They finally gave him the most spectacular refuge in the country. That's what he thinks. That's what I think, too. Phil Norton says he'll never go back to Washington. When he's finished at the Bosque, he's finished. Every morning when he wakes up, he thinks about the cranes. He prepares for them all spring and summer, draining the swamps in March to promote the growth of native plants as food for the birds, reflooding them in late summer to make the birds feel at home when they arrive. He plants chufa, millet, smartweed, and bulrush, which he loves like a doting gardener, and uproots invading salt cedar, which he despises as the viper in his Eden. He cultivates cottonwoods and willows. He plants fields of corn and bumps the corn stalks over on their sides for easy harvesting by the birds. He toils with tractor, disc harrow, bulldozer, and floodgate, restoring the refuge and improving on it, working always against his autumn deadline, the day when the first cranes arrive. He does all this with a small paid staff and an army of volunteers, mostly old folks who migrate like the birds to spend their winters in the Southwest, and who'd rather do something more useful with their days than play bridge or golf. Phil Norton couldn't get along without the volunteers. A retired contractor from Wisconsin designed and built birdwatching stands in the refuge while his wife helped out in the office. There's little to distinguish the volunteers from the professional fish and wildlife staffers. They're all there, shoulder to shoulder in green uniforms, working for the birds. The day I visited, with Phil Norton in charge, 13,000 cranes had already arrived for the winter, with more on the way. That is not to mention the 60,000 ducks on the ponds, quacking their approval of the place, or the 45,000 snow geese feeding in the fields and drifting in long white skeins through the sky. I don't know how anybody could count the hawks and harriers and herons, the bald eagles, the pheasants and turkeys, the owls and meadowlarks and darting swallows, or the clouds of blackbirds rolling and wheeling low above the ground. I spent 2 long days in the bosque and exhausted myself in the beauty of the birds. I ran 4 36 exposure rolls of film through my camera while I was in the refuge. I have rarely been so disappointed by my attempts at photography. A close-up of a sandhill crane does not suggest the teeming multitude, and a wide shot of the multitude becomes a blur. I concluded pictures cannot capture the glory of the Bosque del Apache. You have to be there. And the best time of all to be there is November. Ask the cranes. When I left the Bosque, I headed north toward Albuquerque, Santa Fe, and Taos, along the route of the Royal Road of the Spanish. It's called Interstate 25 now, and the traffic moves way too fast for anybody in a moseying mood, which is the mood I was in. So I left the highway at every promising exit, even some not so promising, like the one at San Antonio, New Mexico. But somebody had said to me, "Don't miss the green chili cheeseburger at the Owl Bar." And unlike most food tips I've collected on the road, this proved to be admirable advice. If you're looking for the bright lights of San Antonio, you will find them entirely concentrated at the Owl. For 50 years, Adolf and Rowena Baca's bar and cafe has been the only social center on a long and lonely stretch of highway. It's not a bit unusual for people to drive 60 miles west from Carrizozo or 60 miles north from Elephant Butte for a chili cheeseburger at the Owl. I meandered back to the Rio Grande in time to catch the reflections of the late afternoon sun on the brown water as I turned north toward Albuquerque. Not that there's very much water in the river this time of year. Will Rogers said the Rio Grande was the only river he'd ever seen that needed irrigating. And Tony Hillerman, the New Mexico novelist and historian, for all his love of the Rio Grande, has acknowledged that in the late fall there are places where you can walk across the riverbed and get nothing on your shoes but dust. Still, the great river is New Mexico's aorta. Without it and its veins, the streams that rush down to it from the mountains, life of any sort would be chancy and improbable. Without the Rio Grande, there would be no Albuquerque sprawling along the east bank, and that night I was very glad there was an Albuquerque, a city with an embracing motel room where I could take a luxurious long shower, put on a clean shirt, and go in search of a proper martini. I found the martini at a cafe near the airport that goes by the unlikely name of the Rio Grande Yacht Club. The bar room was so congenial that I made it my headquarters for the next few nights, occupying the same table by the window, working my way through the menu with the advice of a friendly young waitress named Lisa, and occasionally exchanging rounds of drinks with the regulars. I spent my days in Albuquerque as a contented tourist. I bought some Christmas presents in the Indian jewelry stores and antique shops of Old Town, the adobe plaza surrounding the 18th-century Church of San Felipe de Neri. I stopped into the famous Central Avenue Man's Hat Shop and tried on a $300 beaver cowboy hat. It's amazing how putting on a cowboy hat makes anybody look like a cowboy. Once I read a memoir by a long-haired hippie who crossed the country on a motorcycle. He was hassled by the police and the populace at every stop. Then he bought a cowboy hat. He had no further trouble. He was no longer a long-haired hippie. He was a long-haired cowboy, and that made all the difference in the world. Wearing that hat, even I looked like a cowboy to myself in the mirror of the man's hat shop. I've worn cowboy hats plenty of times on solitary fishing trips in the West, and the one on my head in that store was the best looking I've ever tried on. With its tall black crown and rakish brim, it transformed me from a fat Eastern traveler into a fat Western bull rider. It even came with a card to tuck into the sweatband. Like hell it's yours. Put it back. This hat belongs to blank. Under the spell of my rough beauty in the mirror, I almost reached for my credit card. Just in time, it occurred to me that there was a big difference between wearing a cowboy hat alone on a trout river and committing deception on a city street. It made me sweat just to think about it. Like hell it's yours, put it back, the little card spoke to me. I placed the beautiful black beaver back on the rack and sidled out the door bareheaded. I worked out an agreeable formula for my late lunches in places like La Placita on the Old Town Plaza. One heaping $5 plate of tamales, burritos, or blue corn enchiladas, plus one gigantic $5 margarita, equaled 1 hour-and-a-half nap back at the motel. By the time I woke and typed up my notes for the day, it would be almost time for dinner. I am perfectly capable of succumbing to such a satisfying routine for days at a time, and I might have, except that I'm also an early riser, and in the mornings, I kept seeing the balloons. Albuquerque's cool desert mornings and light winds and open spaces make it the hot air ballooning capital of America. At about the same time of day New Yorkers go briskly out into the streets to walk their dogs, many people in Albuquerque prefer to dawdle around in the sky for a while before breakfast. Some mornings there are so many dawdlers that it gets crowded up there. During the big international festivals, you can look up to the west from Old Town and see 700 brightly colored balloons gently rising and falling and softly bumping into one another. It's one of New Mexico's more flamboyant sights, and a little alarming, unless you understand that these are all licensed pilots who are presumed to know what they're doing. I went for a hot air balloon ride in the Napa Valley of California years ago, when ballooning was a new pastime, and the thought had not yet occurred to anybody that flying a balloon ought to require a license. My pilot that day would have flunked his test and been grounded for life. He said, "I think there are some power lines around here somewhere. Oop, there they are, right behind us. Damn if we didn't just miss them." Well, we missed them. That's the important thing. Have another glass of champagne. The guy's worried-looking wife tried to follow us on the ground with a county map, a pair of binoculars, and an old station wagon. A minute or two after we bounced a few times to a hard landing in a Cabernet Sauvignon vineyard, she pulled up in a cloud of dust to grab a line with her husband and me to keep the balloon from flying away again on its own. This was a struggle that resulted in skinned shins and about an acre of prematurely trampled grapes. We deflated that balloon and rolled it up as fast as we could, stowed the burner in the basket, and got out of there, breathing hard, before anybody could show up from the winery to survey the damage and present a bill. When I had time to think about hot air ballooning later, what I thought was, well, I did it. I'm alive, and I don't have to do it again. But the passage of time and the beautiful sight of balloons wafting above the mists of Albuquerque's mornings finally got to me. There are plenty of balloon excursions listed in the Yellow Pages. I called the one with the cleverest name, Hot Alternatives, and was cheerfully told to roll out of bed the next morning before dawn. Mike Slayton was a banker who took up ballooning as a hobby. He lost his job in one of those cyclical banking layoffs. He went to work for another bank just in time to get laid off by that one, too. He figured ballooning, for all its ups and downs, might prove a more stable line of work than banking and could hardly fail to be more fun. He went out and got a commercial balloon license, bought a leather jacket and a white scarf, and threw away all his neckties. Now he goes around with a smile on his face, a lucky man who has found his calling. The morning's slight breeze floated us east across the mesa toward the river. A balloon can't be steered. It goes where the wind takes it. But it can be manipulated in subtle ways by a good pilot, and I think Mike decided to show off a bit. He let the basket brush the top limbs of the cottonwood trees that line the river, and brought us down to a soft landing on a tiny island in the middle of the Rio Grande. I stepped out to make a few photographs, And when I climbed back in again, Mike gave a short blast of the burners, just enough to lift us away. He had noticed, as I had not, that the breeze was blowing in a different direction along the floodplain. Now it carried us south, a mile or so downriver, with the bottom of the basket gliding no more than 2 inches above the muddy water. A giddy experience, and surely some kind of low-altitude record, even for the skillful pilots of Albuquerque. After that, we lifted up and over the trees again, and in another altitudinal wind shift, right back north and west toward the launching field. A few horses and cows looked up at us vacantly from their farm lots. A woman waved from her kitchen window. The rising sun was beginning to burn off the ground fog over the city to the east. There was something beautiful to see in every direction below. But Mike Slayton didn't notice any of this. He was intent on bringing Starburst to Earth only a few yards from the spot where we had taken off an hour before. And he did it. Lisa and Becky, the ground crew, always prepared in the radio-equipped van to chase the balloon over half the county, didn't even have to start the engine. Perfect morning, perfect trip. I felt exhilarant. Mike wrote my name on the certificate of flight they give to all their patrons, dated it, and presented it to me. Above a glossy gold seal, there was an inscription. The winds have welcomed you with softness. The sun has blessed you with its warm hands. You have flown so high and so well that God has joined you in your laughter and let you gently back into the loving arms of Mother Earth. Very corny, but at the moment it seemed just right. I took the back road north to Santa Fe. Outside a tavern in the old coal mining town of Madrid, I met a young Indian hitchhiker on his way home to Nambe Pueblo and told him I'd take him as far as I was going. I asked him if he could speak any of the Pueblo languages I'd been reading about, Tewa or Tiwa or Tano. He said his grandmother could. I asked him about life at Nambe. He said he wanted to get into the used car business in Albuquerque. He wondered what I thought my rental car was worth. I said I didn't know. We didn't have much more to talk about, so we drove the rest of the way to Santa Fe pretty much in silence. So much for my earnest attempt at cultural exchange. I led him out at another tavern on the edge of town where he said he knew somebody. I have loved Santa Fe since I first saw the old city, bathed in the amazing clear light of its high-altitude setting. That was sometime in my youth, and I have been back fairly often. This trip, somehow, Santa Fe dissatisfied me. It wasn't the accommodations. I treated myself to a romantic adobe casita in the wonderful, shabby-genteel La Posada near the center of town, with lodgepole pine beams overhead in my sitting room, a beehive fireplace in the corner, and a secluded patio outside the door. Everything in Santa Fe was in place as before, the stoic shoulder-to-shoulder row of Indians under the portal of the governor's palace, with their silver and turquoise bracelets spread out on blankets for sale. The art galleries and Navajo rug shops beckoning from the side streets off the plaza. Eastern tourists gawking everywhere as they must have gawked here from the time the Santa Fe Trail brought the first of them to town. Santa Fe was about the same. Maybe I'm the one who has changed. The pastel southwestern paintings in the galleries which used to attract me now seemed mannered and mundane. The food in most of the well-publicized restaurants struck me as pretentious and overpriced. To make things worse, the weather turned cold, and walking into the wind at Santa Fe's 7,000-foot altitude quickly wore me out. It's a great walking city, but when walking becomes more ordeal than pleasure, it's time to pile your 60-year-old bones into the car and get out of town. So that's what I did most days, returning to my cozy casita each night to read by the fireside. I drove to Abiquiu to see once more the gray desert and red hills that inspired Georgia O'Keeffe. She lived in a converted stable there for nearly 50 years, and in a little adobe house in the nearby vastness known as Ghost Ranch. Of the landscape around Abiquiu, she said, "It looks like it's all done for you, the beautiful colors and everything, but just try to get it down on canvas." She never stopped trying until she died. She said God told her that if she painted a certain mountain long enough, she could have it. "Well," she said, "I painted it 15 or 20 times, and it became mine. I went back to Abiquiu to see Miss O'Keefe's mountain." I visited San Ildefonso Pueblo to pay homage to another great artist, Maria Martinez, whose revival of her people's traditional black-on-black pottery made her famous around the world. I wondered whether Maria Martinez and Georgia O'Keeffe ever met, but nobody at San Ildefonso could tell me. I had an encounter with one living artist of New Mexico, Slim Green. I heard of him years ago. Practically everybody with a horse has heard of Slim Green, the old master saddlemaker of Tasuque. I don't have a horse, but I met a man in Wyoming one time who was in the habit of unsaddling after a day's ride and carrying his Slim Green saddle all the way from the barn back to the house, where he kept it dusted and oiled on a rack in the living room. When that saddle wasn't serving as a saddle, it served as an object of art. That's the way people have always felt about their Slim Green saddles, including such famous people as Errol Flynn, Gene Autry, and Robert Redford. I had known Slim Green's legendary name for so long that I assumed he surely had passed on with the other Western legends to that great tack shop in the sky. But one day I heard on the car radio in Santa Fe that Austin Green was going to show off some of his saddles the next morning at the Maxwell Museum in Albuquerque. That was the entire announcement, but I knew it had to be Slim. I woke up early and headed back to Albuquerque. Slim was still alive, all right, and still enthusiastic and talkative at 79, and still, by the way, Slim. He was still making saddles, too, but only three or four a year now, which means that most of the dozens of people on his waiting list, "I do it strictly first come, first served," he said, are going to be disappointed. A little group of admirers came and went through the morning, studying the saddles on display, running their hands over Slim Green's handwork, while the craftsman discoursed on his craft. "I work maybe 100 hours on a saddle," he said, "and these days I charge as much as $7,500, even more if it's a real ornate saddle for a special occasion. So these days, well, figure it out, 4 saddles a year, that's enough to live on. I don't feel I'm cheating anybody. A saddle I sold in 1953 for $300 went for $10,000 last year. That one had my standard flowers, oak leaves and acorns, so that anybody who knows saddles would know right off it's a Slim Green saddle, see? I've never stole another man's flowers, though I've had some of them try to steal mine. All my saddles are custom-made, meaning I take into account the height and weight of the horse and the rider and the shape of the riders behind. Then I start in. I carve the saddle tree out of lodgepole pine and go from there, building up the saddle with layers of shaved leather. My hides all come from the range, not the feedlot, and I take my time when I'm working. No shortcuts." A guy I used to know was always complaining my saddles cost too much, so he found somebody to make him one for less. Pretty soon he came in with that saddle and asked me to repair it. He was rounding up cattle, riding hard, standing in the stirrups, when the right stirrup came right off. He almost fell and killed himself. See, inferior saddle makers are partial to making the right stirrup out of inferior leather, since the left one is the one you always put your weight on to mount the horse. This guy had a right stirrup made from the belly, not the back. That ain't right. I've never done that in my life. Slim Green struck me as the model of the ideal Western man, capable and confident, but reasonable and tolerant too, and blissfully free of the self-importance I've detected in some big city artisans of lesser accomplishment. An Indian woman in the little circle around him, thinking to kid him, smiled and said, "On that covered wagon trip to Texas when you were a little boy, you didn't get ambushed by Indians?" Slim took the question seriously. "No," he said, "I've always got along with everybody. When I came to New Mexico in the 20s, somebody said, Well, now, you're going up there with a lot of different kinds of people with ways you don't know nothing about. I resolved to always meet them halfway, and then take one more little step toward them after that. Those were the words I carried away with me from my morning with Slim Green. Pretty good credo for living in New Mexico, I thought, or any place else. After Slim Green, who seemed young, I went back to my study of oldness. I visited Bandelier National Monument, where the Anasazi lived in caves in a pink wall above a little creek, and farmed the top of the wall, though I could not divine how they got up there to tend their crops. Another day I drove up to Taos for a good lunch of quesadillas. A light snow started falling as I walked around the village and tried to imagine its gaudy past. Well into the 1800s, Taos was the busiest town in New Mexico, its old plaza alive with French trappers and Spanish traders, ecclesiastics saving souls, Indians from the plains swapping captives for corn and beans from the pueblos, and Yankee mountain men trespassing on foreign soil for the pure Yankee hell of it. That was before the writers and artists showed up. Taos was gunslinger Kit Carson's town a long time before it was D.H. Lawrence's. And Taos Pueblo, a couple of miles away, was there a long time before that. You can't visit the Pueblo without thinking this. Here are the real survivors of New Mexico. The Spanish came, the waves of Franciscan friars, the alien trappers, the soldiers of three or four nations. The footloose adventurers came along the Santa Fe Trail, Billy the Kid and all the rest of them. The settlers came, and then the tourists, on horseback, in wagons, in automobiles. The physicists came with their instruments and equations, and on a July morning when their calculations proved accurate, turned square miles of New Mexican desert into green glass. And down the centuries, from the Middle Ages to the Atomic Age to the present day, the people of Taos Pueblo have gone on living in their multi-story structures, fetching their water from wells, baking their bread in outdoor ovens, lighting their lamps at night, a people apart. The people is what they call themselves in their own language. The Hispanics and Anglos, to whom most of New Mexico currently belongs, cannot remember when things were otherwise. But the people remember. They know that others come and go. The people endure. December, New York City. Nobody lives in New York City. That's what people from elsewhere in the country don't understand. They say, I don't see how you can live in a place like New York. Well, I don't. Nobody does. We live in our neighborhoods. These are small towns just like those in Iowa or Nebraska, except that they're not surrounded by farm fields, they're surrounded by other small towns. We have our own small town drugstores and barbershops and hardware stores and cafes, and we know the mailman by his first name, and we say hello to our neighbors on the street, including their dogs and cats. My small town runs from about Jane Street on the north to about Perry Street on the south, between 7th Avenue and Hudson Street. Within these boundaries, I am acquainted with a lot of people and almost nobody in the small towns next door. In December, I came home to my village within Greenwich Village to spend Christmas. The first stop on coming home is the Beatrice Inn, the Italian restaurant in the basement on West 12th Street, to see who's in there. Alice McReynolds is having an early dinner with her friend Geraldine Martin at their table, the one just beyond the door to the kitchen. I can tell you a lot about Alice. When she was a little girl in Washington, she waved to President Wilson, who was riding down R Street in a touring car, and he waved back. How many people do you know who were waved to by President Wilson? Alice's mother and father were married in 1894 and homesteaded a quarter section in Montana at the turn of the century. This grew into a sheep ranch of 17,000 acres. Her father became a Washington lawyer, but returned to the ranch in the summers, and Alice went out there as a proper young Easterner in her early 20s. The place had no sheets on the beds and an outdoor privy. How did she like it? "I blossomed and bloomed," she told me once. Alice is a small woman and must have been a dainty girl, but she rode her cowpony Joker all over the crazy mountains. "I can still smell the sagebrush," she said. "When you go there again, bring me back some sagebrush." As much as Alice loved Montana, though, it was the New York life she yearned for. She came alone in the autumn of her 27th birthday, found a job, and discovered she could go to the Metropolitan Opera for $1. A seat cost $1.50, so Alice stood every Saturday up in the buzzard's roost at the old Met. She liked Wagner because with Wagner you got a lot of music for $1, and because Melchior and Flagstaff sang. How many people do you know who heard Melchior and Flagstaff? Anyway, there's Alice with Geraldine, both of them impeccably dressed, as always. Alice must be feeling better because I notice she's left her cane at home. It's good to see the two of them at their table. And I see Dr. Koth has come across the street to have his dinner. Dr. Koth is a famous podiatrist. He worked on the feet of Catherine Cornell and Vivian Lee. Thousands of other restaurants are serving dinner in New York City tonight, but I bet ours is the only one serving a foot doctor to the stars. The Beatrice Inn was named for Dante's beloved, of course, the Florentine teenager who inspired the greatest poems of the world. Never underestimate what an Italian poet can dash off in the grip of passion. The name has adhered to this 12th Street basement for a long time. The Beatrice was a speakeasy in Prohibition days. There's still a secret bell in the front window frame, the bell the regulars used to ring for admittance. Anybody is welcome now, but I'd say the regulars are still in the majority. We are drawn by habit, by affection for the place, by the good pasta and veal, and by the historic tolerance of the management. Smoking in New York City restaurants has been made a crime by a new generation of the tiresome prudes who outlawed drinking in the 20s. If the small neighborhood places tried to enforce this narrow-minded idea of how life in the city must be lived, they would lose most of their old customers. The Beatrice isn't the only restaurant in the village that survived the 20s by becoming a speakeasy. In the sophisticated world of New York dining, I guess the Beatrice is not an important restaurant. But it is the center of life in my small town, my urban village. I'd be lost without it. For one thing, it's only a block from the house, and I can drop in on the spur of the moment. The first definition of a neighborhood restaurant is that you don't have to make a reservation. For another, I run a tab. My wife gets the bill at the end of the month, and I have the illusion of never paying. Most important of all are Elsie and Aldo and Vivian and Bruno and Marco and Alberto. Elsie is an elegant lady from Genoa. She is active in Italian affairs and is entitled to sign herself Elsie Cardia Cavaliere della Repubblica, an honor that came with a horse in the old days. She and her husband Aldo bought the restaurant back in the 50s. Aldo was a dashing Sardinian from a family of seafarers. As a submarine officer in World War II, he was lucky enough to be captured at sea by a British destroyer and thus to survive the war. Late at night at the Beatrice, after the doors were locked, Aldo used to enjoy bringing out a bottle of Sardinian grappa, sitting down with a few customers who were left, and talking the night away. My wife, Petey, and I felt lucky to know him. We were in the restaurant when word came from St. Vincent's Hospital up the street that Aldo had died. There was a profound silence in the place that night, and some tears. Everybody in the neighborhood loved Aldo Cardia. Some of Elsie's high spirits went with Aldo, but she's carrying on. So are her son, Aldo, who is tall and handsome like his father, and her daughter, Vivian, who is gorgeous and smart, and Bruno Mazza, the dignified chef. How everybody hates it when Bruno takes his summer vacation. And my wise and observant friend Marco Rosasco, the senior waiter, and Alberto Urgeles, the other waiter, unfailingly professional and good-humored. They've decorated the sconces above the tables with holly, and they've twined lights and evergreens around the top of the walls. It's really very pretty. Christmas music is playing softly. You have to listen to be sure it's there. And the atmosphere is warm with conversation tonight. Let's see who else is here. The trim gentleman in the tweed jacket and bow tie is William Mangold, Yale, class of 29. He's having the ossobuco. When Bruno prepares ossobuco, he knows always to save a portion for William Mangold. For 35 years, one week after another, that quiet man in the corner put out the best magazine in the country, The New Yorker, under the great editors Ross and Sean. God, how Bill Mangold must hate the magazine The New Yorker has become. I know, we are in the pounding urban heart of America. It is Christmas time. The Rockefeller Center tree is glowing, and the Fifth Avenue shops are beckoning, and I haven't left this basement on 12th Street yet. It's just that I thought I could tell you more about New York City from a corner of one neighborhood restaurant than by chasing all over town. If you understand this, you understand everything. Certain kinds of people are drawn to this city when they are young. New York calls to them if they want to be writers or painters or actors or singers or dancers, or if they want to make careers in advertising or broadcasting or finance or journalism or publishing or law. Even if the idea of the big city frightens them, they have to come, because New York is the place where they can test themselves against the best. The young people keep coming. Some of them decide it's not worth it and go home. Some of the others, having stayed and experienced New York greatly, are having dinner at the Beatrice Inn tonight. They say there are a million great stories in the city. You can go out and look for them all, or you can sit here in this basement on 12th Street with the Christmas music playing softly and wait for them all to come to you. But I did venture out into some of the other Manhattan principalities because it was Christmas time. New York puts garlands in her hair at Christmas and looks her best, partly because of Lou Dorfman. He is the brilliant designer who gave CBS its style, back when CBS was noted for its style. One December in the 60s, Lou had the idea of decorating the bare trees outside Black Rock, the CBS building at 6th Avenue and 52nd Street. He bought hundreds of thousands of tiny white lights, and he outlined every trunk and branch and twig. At night, that corner became a setting from a fairy tale. Everybody who passed by was enchanted, and the idea caught on. As I made my way around the city in this December, it was hard to find a block without a shimmering row of lighted street trees. They must look especially pretty to Lou Dorfman. From my neighborhood, I inched through the heavy holiday traffic by taxicab and up to the considerably more sumptuous neighborhood of St. Thomas Church on Fifth Avenue. I wanted to hear The Messiah. Actually, it takes a little effort not to hear The Messiah at Christmas time in New York. In the morning paper, I counted advertised performances in 19 places, including sing-along messiahs and a swinging messiah, Too Hot to Handle. But the full-length, three-hour version at St. Thomas had what the others did not, the otherworldly voices of the St. Thomas Boys Choir. The boys are fifth to eighth graders and children of privilege, students at the only church-related residential choir school in the country. They study English, Latin, French, math, history, science, art, and music theory. On Saturdays, they distribute food to the homeless. And they sing 400 pieces of sacred music each year in the five weekly worship services of the church and in concerts around the world. You'd hardly think they'd need a rehearsal for The Messiah, but Jerry Hancock said they did. He has a grand title, Doctor of Music, Organist, and Master of Choristers. And he says he's never quite sure what he's going to hear from the choir from one day to the next. He said these voices are always in a state of flux. This morning, the choir will not sound the same as it did last week. Dr. Hancock has a longer-range worry, too. He said in northern urban places, boys' voices are changing earlier and earlier. This is true of our choir, he said, and it's true in Europe, including Scandinavia. But it's not true in the southern hemisphere. Everybody knows this is happening, and nobody can explain it. It used to be common for us to have 14-year-olds in the choir. Now it's very rare. On the night of the performance, the boys were all innocents, heavenly voices, coming out of cherubic faces, poking out of poinsettia-colored robes. I left exhilarated. In all my years as a reporter, I realized I had let the joy of Christmas get away from me. I had been too busy working in those Decembers past to let the season sink in. I took down A Christmas Carol from the shelf and was surprised to recognize myself a bit in Dickens's description of Scrooge. Oh, but he was a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone, secret and self-contained, and solitary as an oyster. I was glad to have given up the working grindstone and to have time now, as Scrooge had in the end, to take a more generous view of the world. A year of wandering on my own, meeting good people and hearing good stories, had lifted my spirits. Some of the joy of life had come back to me. God bless us, everyone, said Tiny Tim. Christmas Eve arrived with a poignance I hadn't expected. I suppose I'd thought I would always spend my free Christmas Eves at the old home place in North Carolina. But Papa was gone, the house was dark and empty for the first time at Christmas, and my sister and brother were staying home with their families this year. Petey and I made our way through a light rain to a Christmas Eve church service. But ask now the beasts, and they shall teach thee, and the birds of the air, and they shall tell thee. Or speak to the earth, and it shall teach thee, and the fishes of the sea shall declare unto thee. In the Lord's hand is the soul of every living thing. The Reverend William H. Pindar chose that beautiful passage from the book of Job for a reason. Christmas Eve at Central Presbyterian Church on Park Avenue is the night of the blessing of the animals. There were two sets of footprints at the manger, Mr. Pindar said in his sermon, those of human beings and of animals. God put them there so that we could learn to love ourselves better and love all the creatures of creation. Be a better animal yourself in this season. Walk in the rain. Sing even if you are alone. He quoted Gertrude Stein, I am because my little dog knows me. People came down the aisle with their dogs and cats to be blessed. A little girl said to the minister, my dog would try to eat every dog in sight, so I brought my turtle. A little boy brought his gerbils, one in each hand, and held them up for Bill Pender's benediction. One of the choir girls, Casey Kimura, 9 years old, brought her kitten, Topsfield. Elderly women waited in line with their companion dogs, a dachshund, a collie, a pair of young huskies. At least two people brought fish bowls with fish swimming serenely therein. Several children came with their teddy bears. A little boy stood in line gravely holding his yellow rubber duck. Andrew Fulmer, 6 years old, came with a plastic dish containing three worms. He said they are Blackie number one, Blackie number two, and Wiggly. I found them in Riverside Park this fall. They are my only pets. All were duly blessed. An impassive hound looked down upon the proceedings from the first row of the balcony, his face appearing among those of the other parishioners, above an evergreen decoration and a red bow. During Mr. Pender's closing prayer, dogs barked and canaries sang. Then we all sang, "Joy to the world, the Lord is come," and everybody walked out into the rain of Christmas Eve. God bless us, everyone.
Charles Kuralt's America was written and read by Charles Kuralt. It was abridged for audio by Judith Benenson. The recording engineer was Karen Perlman. Editing and post-production by David Gorham. The associate producer was Sloane Seaman. Charles Kuralt's America was produced and directed by Karen Perlman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, Charles Kuralt's A Life on the Road.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.